Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Start off with a little bit about prostate cancer advances, and then we're going to talk about a new exercise to lower blood pressure in only 5 minutes a day and maybe even reduce dementia risk. And of course, your emails and calls. Let's start, first of all, with prostate cancer. I had a question today from a patient. Actually, it's been an ongoing dialogue for several days. Because prostate cancer is a very, very frustrating disease to manage. It's extremely common in Western civilization. Worldwide, there are 1.3 million new cases a year, and it's detected using those PSA levels. But the problem with this disease is that many early stage cancers that are diagnosed that way are not fatal, even if left completely untreated. And the treatment is no walk in the park. In fact, just getting the diagnosis is no walk in the park. And often we're left with a murky, ambiguous situation along the lines of, well, we did the biopsy and we can't find any cancer. But on the other hand, we just poked 12 holes in your little walnut-shaped organ, or if you're a older male, maybe it's, you know, 1.5 walnuts, but it's still fairly small. Well, gee, it's possible we missed, or possibly we caught the edge of something, but we didn't get the center where there actually was cancer. It's an extremely frustrating situation. So what I'm hoping for is improvement in our diagnosis, and that's what my patient was hoping for. So I've got some rays of sunshine that I researched for my guy, and I thought I'd share them with you. The first is coming out of the Queen Mary University of London. This is a new test. It's a blood test and used in conjunction with the existing PSA level. It could be very helpful. So let's start out with the PSA. Most of us have heard of that. It stands for prostate-specific antigen, and that test was actually designed not to diagnose prostate cancer, but instead as a way to track treatment. So it is a tumor marker. And the problem with tumor markers is, well, cancers sometimes in the process of becoming cancers forget how to make the tumor marker. So the absence of the tumor marker can either mean, in that circumstance, that the tumor has forgotten how to make the marker, or it can mean that you don't have the tumor. Well, yeah, exactly. That's kind of a problem. So it isn't that good a screen. It has a lot of false positives, and it misses probably 20% of cancers, particularly the advanced aggressive kind, which are, of course, they've forgotten how to behave themselves in all sorts of ways, including how to make tumor markers. The vast majority of people with elevated PSA do not have cancer. So that's pretty frustrating. False positives of about 75%, 3/4 of the elevations are abnormal. And sometimes even the strength of the elevation, how high it is, isn't all that helpful because a prostate infection or inflammation can kick that up quite high. This new prostate cancer test detects early cancer cells. We call them circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream. Now, these are cancer cells that have left the original tumor and entered the bloodstream prior to spreading around the body. And in order to spread around the body, well, first you have to get on the freeway, then you have to find the on-ramp. So let's talk about that. You have a tumor, a solid mass somewhere in your body. Most of those cells are growing. They've lost their stop signal. So they keep growing even though they should be inhibited when they come into tight contact with other cells. So that's the first stage, is uncontrolled growth. They also have other characteristics which mark them if you can find them at that stage. And that's really part of the holy grail here, is finding those other changes in the bloodstream. But we're not talking about that. We're actually talking about cancer cells. So first, the cells in this mass that have already learned how to grow uncontrollably lose their adhesion. They become detached, and they sit around for a while, and then one of them, maybe just one, will develop mobility, the ability to walk around within the tumor and maybe get into the surrounding tissues. And so I want to emphasize that that's only the first step. The next step in this process is developing mobility, being able to move into the bloodstream. So the cell develops the ability to migrate into the blood or the lymph tissue. And then it has to develop the ability to survive in the bloodstream. That's not so hard. There's plenty of oxygen. There's plenty of sugar. What else does a little cancer cell need? Well, it's just going to float around in the bloodstream unless it develops a way to climb out of the bloodstream. The same thing's true for lymph tissue. So first it has to develop now a new mutation, an adhesion molecule, ICAM it's called, and this allows it to stick to the cell wall. Once it's gotten attached to the cell wall, then it needs a box knife, an ability to unzip the vascular wall and get out into the surrounding tissue. Okay, it's free. It's gotten out of the vasculature. Now it needs to grow. But in order to grow, it needs blood vessels. So that one of the final steps in the development of a cancer is developing the ability to grow new blood vessels. And as you might expect, these are all little bits of DNA that are turning on one after the other to permit this fairly complicated process. And during the course of that, messenger RNA gets released. And if you can capture those cancer cells, because they look different on their surface, you can grab them with an antibody column, and you can, in fact, analyze them and not only say, okay, these are circulating tumor cells, but also how aggressive they are and whether or not they are high probability of being metastatic or whether they're likely to be the ones that just get trapped in the bloodstream on an eternal ride around the body. Well, a research team, this was published fairly recently, I think a year ago in the Journal of Urology, used this circulating tumor test, and they validated it by having 155 newly diagnosed prostate cancers and 98 pre-biopsy patients. Remember, if the PSA test is 75% of the time it's going to be okay, then about 25 of those pre-biopsy patients would have cancer. What they found was that if you used the PSA plus the CTC test ahead of the biopsy, that it was able to predict the presence of aggressive prostate cancer with 90% accuracy. So just finding those cells in the bloodstream that had had those changes told you that this was going to be an aggressive one, not the kind of cancer that you want to leave alone. They also found that they were starting to get a sense that the number and type of cells would also tell them how fast you needed to work or whether this was a cancer that you could sit on. This was an early study. Other studies are ongoing. We're expecting a private test to be available sometime in the next 1 to 3 years. So we don't have it yet. It may be available soon. I'm very excited about the circulating tumor cell test for prostate cancer. But we also have an existing test that looks rather promising. This came out in the March issue of Journal of Urology. This is called the My Prostate Score test. It's already got a startup. It's a urine test. And so in this urine test, they're looking for cancer-specific genes. It's harder to get blood. It's easy to get urine. They've found a really exciting discovery, which is that about half of all prostate tumors have a certain genetic anomaly. This is something they can pick up in this urine test. What happens is the genes for two different areas actually relocate on a chromosome. So clearly that's an error that's happening during cell division, during that early stage when the prostate is just metaplastic, it's getting big. It's making a few typos. Well, one of the common typos is that two different genes on on two different chromosomes actually relocate and produce a new protein, and this new protein is specific to prostate cancer. If a person has a elevated MyProstate score, and there are other genes that they're looking at on this test, it would be lovely that if we validated, because they might be able to avoid a biopsy. They might be able to see whether or not they have cancer. This coupled with an MRI scan that was low risk, and this test being low risk, might save someone from having to have a biopsy and allow them to monitor themselves, maybe get a subsequent MRI. So far, we have one validation study that they quote here in the article. This was 15,000 patients. 22% had high-risk cancers that would have been the ones that you would really want to be treating. So that means that 78% of them didn't have high-grade cancers. What they calculate is if they could have used this test, the 387 biopsies that found no cancer or a slow-growing cancer could have simply been avoided. It would have missed about 10 clinically significant cancers. Well, that's out of 1,500. That's not too bad, and way better than what we've got with the PSA. So I think what we're going to see in the future is a combination of these tests coming forward and giving us what we really need, which is accurate, non-invasive prostate cancer testing. Now we're going to pivot just slightly over to some interesting new research on advanced prostate cancer. And this is kind of worrisome. When a person has advanced prostate cancer that's spread to their other body tissues, it's spread to their lymph nodes, often prostate cancer likes to spread to the bone, we use a type of drug called antiandrogens. Think of them as anti-testosterones. We do something similar in women with breast cancer. If they have estrogen receptors, they get an anti-estrogen, either a blocker or a drug that prevents the production of estrogen. This anti-androgen therapy is a pretty tough therapy. It gives people effectively menopause. If you're a male, effectively, it's kind of a chemical castration, at least so far as the brain is concerned, and you do get a lot of hot flashes. Ironic personal aside, I found this amusing, and it may not have anything to do with the anti-androgens, but many years ago now, when my father was first diagnosed with prostate cancer, he underwent radiation therapy and then went on anti-androgen therapy. And my father had always been kind of the strong, silent type. He wasn't a very talkative person. And it may have been the diagnosis of cancer, or it may have been the fact that he was on a drug that changed the testosterone levels in his brain. But my father began to talk. He began to tell me stories. We began to have very deep and the kind of wonderful conversations that you hope that you have with your adult parent once you're adult enough to have them, and that many people don't get to have. So I'm very grateful to the anti-androgens. I don't really know if they helped my father survive any longer than he otherwise would have. He eventually succumbed to the disease. But at least it helped us, you know, mature and develop a more profound relationship, which we both valued very much. Okay. Personal stuff aside, there's a problem. And the problem is that recent research has suggested that, in fact, rather than preventing bone metastases, the use of these anti-androgen drugs may actually facilitate bone metastasis. This is interesting. It's as if it creates an evolutionary pressure, which in the process of responding to the evolutionary pressure, the prostate cancers that have been able to grow in the bone develop new characteristics that make them a more aggressive bone tumor than if the person had never been on the anti-androgen drugs. The way they discovered this, because if you stop and think about it, how on earth are you going to figure this out? I mean, you're dealing with a black box here with the human body. But over the last few years, researchers have used 3D printing to build these miniature organs, organoids they're called, and seed a biomimetic scaffolding, often the same material that we make sutures out of, the absorbable sutures. They seed those with patient-derived bone cells, stem cells, that is, and make essentially a little mini bone. And then they seed them with tumor cells, and they use that to test these drugs. And this is where it emerged that the anti-androgens caused a more rapid progress only in the mineralized microenvironment of bone tumors. When you were in a petri dish that wasn't an organoid, you saw inhibition. So there's something about the bone environment plus the anti-androgens, which may be exactly the wrong thing to be doing. So maybe we don't want to give these to people who have had, who have bone mets already. Maybe we want to reserve them for people who have, say, just lymphatic tissue metastasis, and they would, of course, be on long-term suppressive therapy. There's no evidence that this happens in lymphatic tissue. I want to emphasize that part of our dilemma with prostate cancer is it's very common in older men. And I saw this statistic, it kind of jumped out at me. In Australia, which has the highest rates of prostate cancer in the world, one out of every six Australians gets prostate cancer in their lifetime. One out of every six. And that's 17,000 a year. But only 3,000 a year die of it. So should we be treating it aggressively? Should we let nature take its course? Can we find some middle ground that helps us separate the aggressive tumors from the less aggressive ones, such that we can do something more rational for these people rather than subjecting them to very aggressive diagnostic studies, which may in fact not give us a diagnosis? So how about this? We know that walking 30 minutes a day lowers your blood pressure by about 10 points, but it takes 30 minutes a day. A new research study shows that a 5-minute breathing workout lowers blood pressure as much as exercise and about as much as the same level that it would take to get a drug approved. Wow. It's about 10 blood pressure points, by the way, is the threshold for getting a new drug out there. Works as well as a new drug. Hey, we might want to spend that 5 minutes. So what am I talking about? We're talking about a maneuver called high resistance inspiratory muscle strength training. Anyone who's had surgery in the past has probably experienced a version of this in the form of the incentive spirometer that they give you after your surgery to get you to take big, deep breaths. It's a little ping pong ball in a tube. And when you suck in on the tube, you fill your lungs and you're supposed to pull that ping pong ball up to a mark. And then when that gets easy, they raise the mark. When you're under anesthesia and you're under surgery, they don't fill your lungs all the way up. It's a tidal volume breathing, which keeps enough oxygen in your blood. But during the surgery, you're lying down, you're not breathing normally. The lower parts of the lungs kind of collapse on themselves. And that is a great place for bacteria and post-operative pneumonia to get going. So this incentive spirometry has been around for easily 30 years as a preventative. Well, this is similar. It's basically a high-resistance inhalation, and it was developed way back in the 1980s to help critically ill respiratory disease patients strengthen their diaphragm and their other breathing muscles, the so-called accessory breathing muscles between the ribs. So what's involved is inhaling vigorously through a handheld device, which provides resistance. They describe it as sucking hard on a tube that sucks back. What they found was 30 inhalations a day at this high resistance, 6 days a week, could reap substantial cardiovascular, cognitive, and sports performances. And I want to add, you can go and buy this device online, probably from a medical supply store, IMST. They took 36 people with normal blood pressure, with above normal blood pressure, excuse me, with hypertension, ages 50 to 79. And half of them did this every day for 6 days out of seven for 6 weeks, and half did a placebo protocol where they had a device, but the resistance was much lower. So the IMST group dropped 9 points on the average on their blood pressure. And as I said, that's equal to the effects of some drugs. What's even more important is at the end of the 6 weeks, the IMST group maintained that improvement. They tested some things. They found that they had a 45% improvement in vascular endothelial function. That's huge. That's the ability for the arteries to expand when they're stimulated by adrenaline. And they saw a significant increase in levels of nitric oxide, which is the key neurotransmitter molecule, although it's not a neurotransmitter in this case because it's not in the nerve, but it is a signaling molecule that dilates arteries and also prevents plaque buildup because it's directly anti-inflammatory. Now, normally as we age, we lose nitric oxide. People with quote-unquote white coat hypertension, where you get high blood pressure in the doctor's office, you have this. You have decreased nitric oxide levels. You don't see white coat hypertension in 18-year-olds. It's the adrenaline from the doctor's office, performance anxiety, if you will, and that doesn't kick up nitric oxide the way it should because the blood vessel wall can't respond. Well, this helped the blood vessel wall recover. I'm all over nitric oxide. I am. If you've listened to my talk about high blood pressure and natural medications, you've heard me mention L-citrulline, L-arginine, which goose the enzyme that makes nitric oxide, and also eating nitrates, which foods like celery and beets that are naturally high in nitrates, because this helps also with the production of nitric oxide. They also found that stress markers and markers for oxidative stress dropped, inflammation markers dropped. They were all lower in the IMST group. And the compliance was great. 95% of the sessions were completed, which is way good for any kind of medical intervention where you have to get actual wild-type humans to do anything. They think it's going to be particularly helpful in postmenopausal women because that's a group that doesn't get as much benefit from exercise if they're not taking supplemental estrogen. Now, that puts out a word for supplemental estrogen, I think. If you are taking even low levels of supplemental estrogen, you benefit from an aerobic exercise program as well as men do. If you're not, you don't get as much benefit. So this might be a way to get around that for people who, for whatever reason, possibly a strong family history or a personal DNA or a personal history of breast cancer, makes them nervous about doing that. And that's completely understandable. But maybe we don't have to trade off cancer versus heart disease. They also suggest that some measures of brain function improved. That probably has to do with increasing nitric oxide in the brain, because in the brain, nitric oxide is actually an anti-inflammatory, and we know that brain function is impaired by inflammation. So it could be a blood vessel flow effect, or it could be something even more important. Very exciting, either way. We're going to take one email before the break. This one is just a comment. This is from Andy in Santa Cruz. Subject, non-vaccinated family call last week. Thank you so much for taking the non-vaccinated family member question last week. My mom is immunocompromised. My dad won't get the vaccine for moral reasons. They live together. I'm immunocompromised and have to keep saying no when they want to come visit. It's a real persistent societal problem with real consequences. So thanks for discussing it. I'm sure you're sick of that too. Well, I would say sick is not the right word. I would say sad. Sad and kind of quoting the bard with Lord, what fools these mortals be. But there you are. Okay, so got another one. This is just a little tidbit from a patient who developed postural tachycardia syndrome after his COVID-19 case. And what's interesting about this is a very intelligent university professor, this patient. And so he went lurking around and found an actual public health report in an obscure journal from September of 2020 that showed that postural tachycardia syndrome after COVID-19 does occur. This is a single case, but that's how it works in science. This was from the Autonomic Division of Stanford University's Neurology Department. Those folks rock, I will add. They've got the equipment. They know how to make the diagnosis. But autonomic dysregulation, I think, may be a big part of some cases of long COVID. And what that feels like is it feels like your heart beats too fast and you get dizzy. In the case of this poor unfortunate woman, She was a 26-year-old emergency department nurse in great health. She caught COVID, and about 7 days into the illness, she got pneumonia. And about a week after that, she had very rapid heartbeat, like 150 after showering, and her blood pressure was up at 156 over 112. Then she started getting faint, but the problem was she was faint with a blood pressure of 146 over 100. Normally, people feel faint when their blood pressure is 80 over 40. Why was hers happening? Well, because her autonomic nervous system was completely confused. Remember what I said about adrenaline raising the blood pressure? Where in her case, it was raising the blood pressure, but it was also speeding up the heart so much that the heart didn't have time to fill. She went through an elaborate testing, which I won't go through, and they tested her for everything else, and all they can find in this particular case report is that this appears to be a case, a documented case of COVID-19 induced POTS. So rapid heartbeat and feeling faint at the same time. There's a lot of things that can cause that. But in a young, healthy person who had a case of COVID, they need to be tested for autonomic instability and particularly postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Interesting thing about this is the POTS syndrome we're talking about usually starts after a virus. 28 to 41% of cases, in this case it was COVID-19, but it could have been other viruses. It's worth noting that she has a twin sister who also got POTS, so there's probably some really special DNA going on, and I imagine those folks at Stanford are studying it. So we're going to another email, this from Nick in Aptos, and Nick writes, subject, The Guardian article on gut microbiome. Hello, Dr. Don. Have you seen the below article? What do you think of it? Does it seem like a semi-professional article or not? And thank you very much for sharing this with me, Nick. I actually thought it was, even maybe I would call it professional for the general public press. There's a little bit of hype on, a homegrown product, but that's to be expected. It probably grew out of a press release. But it's a good discussion of recent research on the microbiome. I'm going to abstract just a little bit of it. I don't think anyone who's a regular listener hasn't heard me talk about the microbiome. So let's just say that we are a planet. We have a jungle of bacteria growing inside our bodies, and they have so many interactions with our health and well-being that it's literally mission critical. There's good evidence that many of the diseases that affect modern man didn't affect ancient man and don't affect people growing in underdeveloped or less developed countries. Things like asthma, food allergies, atopy like eczema, and autoimmune diseases are much less common there. Probably the unintended benefit, shall we say, of being exposed to lots of bacteria, many of them, moderately good for you and taking up residence in your gut. In order to have a healthy gut, you need about 30 grams of fiber a day, but very few people get that. And the more sugar and salt you eat, the less likely you are. And here's something else. Processed foods in general have less fiber, but when I go, let's say, to look for a salad dressing in the store, I happen to know the names of the emulsifiers, which are basically detergents. If you eat emulsifiers, you're going to have less gut diversity and more inflammation in your gut, more bad actors. The emulsifiers, well, what do? Those are the thickeners in all of the sauces. Those are in salad dressing in particular. I've been able to find like one brand of salad dressing that doesn't have emulsifiers. Essentially, this is not good for your microbiome. The hype that I mentioned is related to this concept, which I do not think is ready for prime time, of giving people a sort of personalized diet based on their microbiome genetic blueprint. There are a few problems with that. Number one, when you do a microbiome genetic blueprint, it's a single snapshot. It doesn't really reflect what's actually going on in the person. Secondly, some of those bugs are good and some of those are bad, and you're picking out the ones that you know to be good, which may not be the entire crew, and giving them a, you know, a dietary plan, which they could probably figure out themselves without paying $350 for the analysis. What they're premising the study on, my friend Nick, is that the microbiome in the individuals they're testing is optimized for the individuals, and therefore you want to feed a diet that's going to feed the good guys and starve out the bad guys, and that we know exactly how to do this. I don't think we're there yet. I think that maybe we need another 100,000 individuals submitting poop specimens for over, let's say, on a weekly basis for a year, and a machine algorithm looking through all of that. And then I think we might be able to say something. But unfortunately, everyone's very enamored right now with big data, and correlation does not equal causation, guys. Please. It's not the same thing. Things can run together in parallel, and one doesn't cause the other. So many microbiome scientists don't have much time for the commercial probiotics industry because you can't just pick one. The science isn't there yet. We're lumping together probiotics, but the problem is that about 70% of what's in the human microbiome has never been grown in a lab and can't be manufactured. The article talks about, well, we need more information. We need more precision so we can build this customized microbiome and pinpoint certain diseases. But we're not building a bridge here. This is not engineering. And all of those bacteria, fungi, and viruses interact with each other. It's way too complicated to approach like an engineer. We have to approach it like a gardener. A commercial approach that doesn't involve really emphasizing the prebiotics is, in my opinion, going to fail. Now, there are a few that may have potential. They're called live biotherapeutics. There's a professor, Ingvar Bjarnason, a GI doctor, who's done double-blind placebo studies on very specific probiotic blends. But there was one study that he did on irritable bowel syndrome. And this drug seemed to help with irritable bowel, but more importantly, it acted as a treatment for acute COVID. It's a small study, but they gave very ill people who were admitted to the hospital with COVID the probiotic, and this reduced the rate of need for a ventilator. In other words, the very, very severe intensive care unit COVID, which increases your risk of death and respiratory failure. So it's a small study, but it's interesting because subsequent to last summer, we learned that COVID persists in the gut and messes up the microbiome in many people. So it's an inflammatory thing. It disrupts the balance, and that balance stays disrupted. One last thing that I thought was very useful was the discussion of Bifidobacterium longum infantis. This is a type of bacteria that basically exists to allow babies to digest oligosaccharides in breast milks. These are sugars that are in milk, but in babies who don't get them from their mother, because their mother didn't get them from their mother, because their mother got antibiotics for an ear infection at 2 weeks old or whatever, wiped out the bifidobacterium, you've stopped the line. It's like a genetic transfer, but it's not genetic, it's bacterial. And if the mother can't transfer it, the baby can't get it. So nowadays, in the Western world, the baby poop is actually different than the baby poop in the developing world. If you look, it correlates really well with how much Bifidobacterium longum infantis there is in the child. There are studies in mice that feed it breast milks and measure what comes out. It shows that all the sugars are digested. If you put this bug back into children, especially preterm children in neonatal ICU, we might actually have a substantially positive impact on those poor kids throughout the rest of their life. So we know that the microbiome also, among all these other things, ferments products, makes things that we can't make. Vitamin K is an example. We can't make that as newborns, so we get a shot of it to prevent hemorrhage. The fermentation of fiber in the gut creates products called short-chained fatty acids, and some of these look very, very much like some of our mood-stabilizing drugs. The more fiber you eat, the more substrate you have to turn into short-chain fatty acids. So it may be that a high-fiber diet may actually provide benefit for people with low-grade depression or low-grade anxiety. It's not a drug, and it's widely available. So eating fermented foods, working up slowly to 30 grams of fiber a day, and try to make that from a variety of different sources, and more omega-3s, because the gut microbes, they like those omega-3s. The humans that those bacteria evolved to live inside were eating a diet that was much more balanced, with omega-3s being maybe half to a third the omega-6s, rather than the modern American diet, where the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is more like 10 or 15 to 1 because of the way we process our foods. So it's all connected, and I always keep saying this. So Nick, thank you for giving me a chance to extol the virtues of the microbiome. Let's go on to our next email. This is from Sybil in SoCal. The euphonious Sybil wants me to elaborate on lecithin as a supplement for a healthy brain. I had mentioned on a previous show, but I don't think Sybil caught it, that phosphatidylcholine is produced by the body when you eat lecithin, and that is very healthy for the brain because it goes straight into the cell wall membrane and helps it be more flexible, which means that the neurotransmitters work better. A stiff brain is a slow brain. 5 grams a day is a very safe dose. It's been tested for safety in the ultimate guinea pig for humans, which is to say breastfeeding moms. And in fact, that dose of lecithin is helpful for clogged milk ducts. So if you're having problems with your breastfeeding, 5 grams of lecithin is helpful. Next question from Sybil. A lot is said about the benefits of MSM for joints. How much should we take from this supplement? And Sybil, I'm going to have to take the fifth on this. I don't particularly recommend MSM for joints. Sometimes it's along for the road, and I'll go ahead and give it to someone because I'm giving them glucosamine sulfate and chondroitin sulfate. I'll give out doses for those. Glucosamine sulfate, 1,200 milligrams a day, very helpful for joints. Other things I give, Boswellia, 500 milligrams, 3 times a day. Curcumin, highly absorbable, or liposomal, 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams a day, and about 4 ounces of tart cherry juice. That plus the omega-3s, which I've already talked about, but about 2,000 milligrams of omega-3s, EPA and DHA need to be, those are subcomponents, they need to be at least 1,000. That's kind of my basic go forward with arthritis. Plus, I love topical CBD on joints like finger joints that you can get to that don't have a lot of fat. Final question. I have a friend whose husband is 77 and gets blue fingers. She suspects Raynaud's disease. Could it be something else, and what could he do about it? Well, blue fingers can also be from pulmonary disease, so it's important that we rule that out. People with severe congestive heart failure can also have problems with their circulation, but I'm assuming we'll have to exclude those. What you do about Raynaud's, which is a vascular spasm, remember what was said about the nitric oxide and the hypertension? Well, those same things, eating a diet high in nitrates, taking L-arginine and L-citrulline, about 5 grams a day of those, that can help with this. Hawthorn tincture, a tincture of hawthorn and just follow the package instructions, is also good for stabilizing the blood vessels. But one of my go-tos has nothing to do with putting something in your mouth. It has to do with putting something on your torso. I really like those little zip-up vests. Some of them are polyfill, some of them are down, some of them are polar fleece, but they all work well to get you a little hot under the collar. And if you're warm on your torso, you can overcome the Raynaud's because your body will want to send blood to the fingers to get rid of the excess heat. So if her husband is, you know, moderate to chilly and he can put up with being a little warm, that's probably going to help with his Raynaud's without having to take any medications or supplements. So I hope that was helpful. Let's go to another story. Fibromyalgia. The last few years, this has been framed as a brain disease, a problem with a central disorder in the pain sensing part of the brain. And that's been based on MRI results that show that that part, that the brain is more active in the pain sensing areas in people with fibromyalgia. So they've gone after that because that's what they can see. But remember, correlation does not equal causality. So when you see the two things that show up together, which is the chicken and which is the egg? Well, that's the question. I think we may have been barking up the wrong tree because none of the therapies that have emerged as a result of the brain disorder hypothesis have actually materialized with any good therapy. But this particular alternative hypothesis maybe will. So a group at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology, and Neuroscience at King's College London has shown that many of the symptoms of fibromyalgia syndrome are caused by antibodies that increase the level of pain-sensing nerves through the body. And they did this in a really fascinating way. This was published in the July issue of the Journal of Clinical Investigation, and it showed that increased pain sensitivity, muscle weakness, reduced movement, and also a reduced number of small nerve fibers in the skin, these are all typical of fibromyalgia syndrome, are all a consequence of patient antibodies. The researchers injected mice with antibodies from people who had fibromyalgia syndrome and observed that the mice rapidly developed an increased sensitivity to pressure and cold, as well as displaying reduced movement, reduced grip strength. And mice that got antibodies from healthy people were unaffected, not demonstrating any change in their behavior. Furthermore, over time, in other words, the several weeks that it would require for the antibody levels to drop, since these were foreign antibodies, the mice's body rejected them eventually and they were broken down. Once the antibodies were cleared from the mice's system, they recovered. This is really important because we have therapies that can reduce antibody levels. And in fact, we use them for certain autoimmune diseases. For example, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which has been in the news lately. And plasmapheresis is one of these therapies. And this is essentially filtering out the antibodies from the serum and putting the red blood cells back in, but keeping the antibodies out. This is potentially a therapy that could transform the way that fibromyalgia is treated. I could see it being something like a dialysis situation where you go in periodically and get your blood washed. Who knows? This could be a rejuvenation therapy as well. Time will only tell. But it's common enough. 1 in 40 people have fibromyalgia syndrome. It can occur in children. Many of the quote-unquote long COVID cases are showing this sort of decreased pain threshold or increased pain level and increased sensitivity to temperature, which makes sense if this is triggering an autoimmune disease. There have been two different studies, one in the UK and one in Sweden. They both gave similar results. That's great. You want something this much of a game changer to replicate. But the next step is really to figure out what the antibodies bind to, what they're attaching to, and where those are. Now, I want to just take a moment and talk about this idea of autoimmune and immune inflammation, because fibromyalgia syndrome, until the brain hypothesis caught fire a few years ago, was thought to be a spectrum disease. And on one end of the spectrum is the physical disease where people are tired and they have pain. On the other end were people who were disabled from fatigue and had brain fog. Both conditions actually do have a form of brain fog. But this was the chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And sometimes this is now called encephalitic myalgia because it's an itis. And because we're searching to understand it, so we give it all these fancy names that make us feel like we know what we're talking about. But chronic inflammatory response syndrome or chronic fatigue syndrome or whatever you want to call it is seen after infections, viral infections. It's also seen after exposure to toxins. It's seen after Lyme disease in some individuals. And some people with chronic fatigue have something on this spectrum. other people probably have an autonomic disorder. Other people probably have something else entirely. So because we don't have any ways of differentiating these effectively, we got very excited about the brain thing in the fibromyalgia. Now I want to go back and take a look at all of these chronic fatigue patients and see if their brains show up anything, or if we really do have certain antibodies that are going in the brain that are creating the inflammation that's showing up on the functional MRI. It's a fascinating puzzle, but it's not just academic. There are literally millions of people who are disabled by this condition. And it would be wonderful if we could figure this out. This disease has been around forever. They used to call it neurasthenia in Sherlock Holmes' time, but it's the same thing. You read the descriptions, and it's the same thing, and it's a scourge, and we don't have any good therapy for it, with all the king's horses and all of the king's men. So I really hope that we will see, based on this, maybe some additional movement in that direction. Just a quick clinical cautionary tale. 35-year-old white male walks into an urgent care center. He's complaining of shortness of breath, getting out of breath when he exercises, when he lies down at night. He wakes up gasping for air. His legs are a little swollen. When you listen to his lungs, you hear some crackly noises as if there was fluid in the lungs. Now, 20 years ago, we'd diagnose maybe pneumonia and varicose veins. But now there's a new kid on the block. Methamphetamine dilated cardiomyopathy. The statistics on this are really nothing short of astonishing. And we know that methamphetamine is an addictive stimulant. We know that it affects the cardiovascular system. It increases spikes in blood pressure. It can cause angina, heart spasm. Turns out it also increases plaques in the arteries, and it rewires the heart's electrical system permanently, causing a person to be more likely to experience arrhythmias. But what I didn't realize was the number of heart failure cases. So methamphetamine-related heart failure hospitalizations went up 600% in the decade between 2008 and 2018. And most of these people were younger men between 35 and 54 without any pre-existing cardiovascular conditions. White men predominantly. The demographics are shifting. It's my prediction that as more and more methamphetamine, and particularly the stronger varieties that have come out in the last few years, make its way through our communities, that we're going to start seeing this syndrome in people of color, in more women. It's going to universalize, which is a very, very sad thing. I'm putting this out to the nurses and doctors in my audience, of which I know there are a substantial number. If you see something that smells like heart failure, you're probably looking at methamphetamine dilated cardiomyopathy diagnosed by ultrasound, or maybe if you had a really, really good auscultation teacher in medical school and it's really quiet in your ER, you might be able to hear the S3 and the S4 gallops that would give you the clue of that. But most of us now just go for the echo. Well, let's end on a few good news topics. I've got just enough time to talk about one of my favorite topics, the microbiome. Oh, we didn't do any epigenetics this time. So, starting with the microbiome, we've talked a little bit about the gut microbiome earlier, but there's a microbiome in the vagina, and researchers are looking at one of the most pesky problems for women, which is bacterial vaginosis. This just gives you a funky discharge and a smell, and you have to use antibiotics to get rid of it. They get rid of it, but it keeps coming back, partly because the antibiotics also get rid of the protective flora. The female reproductive tract, the vagina, is typically colonized by a lot of lactobacillus, an acid-loving bacteria that turns glucose from the epithelial cells that are shed by the skin into acid because it likes acid. And the acid inhibits the development of these other bacteria. We've never really had a good sense for what the contributing bacteria are. Sure, we know what we can culture if we do that, but that's not what's actually causing the bacterial vaginosis. It turns out it is a species of anaerobic bacteria called Veillonellaceae. Boy, that's really a mouthful. If you want to learn more about this particular family of bacteria, go ahead and Google V-E-I-L-L-O-N space bacteria, and it'll come up. They also set up the environment that allows the bacterial vaginosis to keep coming back. And the way they do that is by decreasing lactate. They eat the lactate that the lactobacillus is producing. They basically prevent the lactobacillus from being protective. And we're off to the races, a whole new loop. Now, of course, that bacteria end up in the guts of babies born through those vaginas. This recent study just came out, looked at boys with a particular bacteria, Bacteroides species, in their gut at 1 year of age. When they were tested on language skills and cognition a year later, they were smarter than the babies who had low levels of Bacteroides. This only works for the boy babies. It was not statistically significant for girls, but what they did find was that girls have more of this particular type of bacteria anyway. What's up with that? No idea. How do you get it? Well, you get it from being born through a vagina. If you have a C-section, it's going to deplete it. Other things that help recovery: breastfeeding, high-fiber diet, living with a dog, definitely living with a dog, and being exposed to nature in green spaces. So if your baby boy was born by cesarean, you do him a favor by giving him all those things. What's going on? Well, Bacteroides produces sphingolipids, which are an important component for the development of the brain. So if you make a lot of those in the baby is smarter, and smarter at least at the testable age of 2 on their verbal skills. So it's impressive. I think it's crazy. But the more we learn about the microbiome, the more it turns out to be key to human health. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.